Once upon a time, humans started telling stories.
Where are these stories coming from, Larry?
Anywhere. It doesn't matter, anywhere. The newspaper. Pick a story, any story.
How do the stories we tell shape who we are, both as individuals and as a species?
Immigrants, protests, budget cuts, and literacy program.
Human spirit overcoming economic adversity sounds like Horatio Alger in The Burial. Put Jimmy Smits in it and you got a sexy stand to deliver.
Humans are so fond of stories, novels, movies, mythology, gossip, radio shows. It's a wonder we have time to achieve anything useful.
Is there an evolutionary advantage to storytelling?
How about Mudslide Kills 60 in Slums of Chile?
That's good. Triumph over tragedy sounds like a John Borman picture. You still have a happy ending on it, the script will write itself.
Our guest is Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal.
The Evolution of Storytelling. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
And they live happily ever after. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today's broadcast originates from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
It's a continuation of conversations that start at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. Stanford is where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
And today we're philosophizing with you about the evolution of storytelling.
Evolution, huh? Are you telling me that storytelling was somehow involved in the evolution of the human species? That it's an adaptation? Something with a survival function, like opposable thumbs? Or do you just mean that storytelling has changed as human culture and technology have developed?
Well, I think both things are probably true, but let's start about thinking about the evolutionary function of storytelling. It's a curious fact, don't you think? Humans from every part of the globe, from every epoch in human history, tell stories. It's a universal human trait. And moreover, no other animal tells stories. That combination of fact, the universality and distinctiveness of it, suggests that we evolved into storytelling creatures and that we did so because there was some evolutionary point to our storytelling.
Well, maybe it suggests it to you, but just because we're the kind of creatures that like to tell stories doesn't really mean that storytelling is adaptive. There's all kinds of traits we have, and the fact that we have any given trait, whether it's a tendency to tell stories or something quite different, like eating sugary foods, for example, that doesn't mean that that trait has or ever had any adaptive function. It could have no function. It could just be an evolutionary accident. Or it might even be maladaptive, like my sweet tooth.
But, John, I'm going to admit, look, it's true, we consume far too much refined sugar, but in fact, we did evolve into sugar-craving creatures, and we evolved into sugar-craving creatures for a reason. Way back in the Pleistocene, it was important to get as much sugar as we could. I mean, high-caloric foods were in scarce supply, and sweet foods gave us an injection of energy. Of course, nowadays, it's way too easy to find such foods, and often when we find them, they're the wrong kind. So the sweet tooth that was once adaptive has become maladaptive in the current environment. I admit that.
Well, you make a valid point. Even if a trait is maladaptive or non-adaptive now, it might have once had an adaptive function. Eating hi-hos might have been great for our ancestors and given them an evolutionary edge, but now it just threatens me with diabetes.
Which raises a kind of interesting possibility, I guess. It could be that the human habit of telling stories served our ancestors really well and gave them some evolutionary edge, but it doesn't follow from that it has the same benefit for us in our modern technological society.
Well, I still think the more likely possibility is it's just an evolutionary byproduct with no particular function at all.
Oh, you're so skeptical, John, but let's just think at least about the possible evolutionary advantages of storytelling. I mean, here's one possibility. Human life has always been full of stress and strain. Maybe the capacity to tell stories evolved to give us a way to avoid our troubles and get lost in worlds of the imagination. How's that for a hypothesis?
Well, it's a hypothesis. Well, it's a story is what it is. It's a just-so story. It's one explanation, but you could come up with dozens of others, I bet.
Well, there are other possibilities. I mean, think of, like, sexual selection. Maybe telling stories is a way to get and hold another person's attention. Think of birds that sing beautifully. They're better able to attract mates. It could be that good storytellers are better able to attract mates, you know, to get more sex.
Oh, come on, Ken. I love a good story as much as the next guy, but I'm not convinced that your evolutionary fantasies have any credence at all. I'm sure you could come up with a number of other just-so stories if you thought about it longer.
Well,
how would we tell which function, if any, were the real reason why we evolved this trait? Does there have to be a single function? Could they all contribute? Or, as I think, is the fact that we love to tell stories just a happy accident?
You know, I'm going to admit those are very good questions, and in the course of this show, we're going to have to deal with just those questions.
You know, even if you manage to establish that there was a particular function storytelling once served our ancestors, it doesn't automatically follow that it still serves that function or that that's still the reason we tell stories here in the 21st century.
You know, John, I admit you're right, but here's something I know. Whether it be on the plains of the Pleistocene or next to the water cooler, great storytellers all have something in common. They know when to exaggerate, and that can make it sometimes hard to distinguish fact from fiction. So, you know what we did? We sent a roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to find out more about the science and art of confabulation. She files this report.
Facts are stupid things. Stubborn things, I should say.
One of Ronald Reagan's favorite stories was about a World War II pilot who ordered his crew to bail out of their crippled B-17 bomber. One of the men couldn't because he'd been injured. So according to Reagan, the pilot sacrificed himself and said the words, "Never mind, son, we'll ride it down together." Reagan told the story before the Congressional Medal of Honor Society. He said the pilot was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously. It's a good story, but there's no evidence that it's true. Reagan was probably conflating fact with a scene from the 1944 film Wing and a Prayer.
Mike, are you okay?
It's my leg, sir.
Can you move them?
We're burning back here. You'd better bail out, sir.
I haven't got the altitude, Mike. We'll take this ride together.
We know now, of course, that memory is not an accurate videotape recording, that each time memories are recalled, they're slightly altered.
William Herstein is a professor at Elmhurst College and author of the book Brain Fiction. He studies the science of confabulation, or false memories. Herstein recalls one patient he met years ago named David, a young man who was seriously injured in a car accident. David lost his right arm in the crash and hit his head hard, but he was alive and otherwise okay.
And his parents said, oh, by the way, he doesn't acknowledge that we're his parents.
That caught Herstein's attention. David was insisting that his parents were imposters.
When his parents went to see him in the hospital, just refused to acknowledge their identity. One of the odd peculiarities of David's case was that when his parents would call him on the telephone, he would admit their identity. So it was modality specific. Visually, he would deny them, but auditorily, he would acknowledge that they were who they were.
Turns out David had injured his brain, the prefrontal cortex, and the temporoparietal junction, the part that helps us understand the psychology of other people. He was suffering from a condition called Capgras syndrome.
Typically, you'll get very florid confabulations from these patients if you ask them, why on earth would someone pretend to be your father or mother? And like one of our patients said, well, I don't know, perhaps my father went away and hired this man to take care of me.
In comparing brain scans of people who tell made-up stories and people who recall real memories, Herstein says different parts of the brain light up, so it's very clear whether a person is telling the truth. But exaggerating or telling little lies can eventually lead to real false memories.
If you create vivid mental imagery, and then months or years later you recall that imagery, it's very easy to mistake that imagery for an actual experience. So studies have shown that people who are good imaginers and are able to create vivid mental imagery are more subject to this effect.
But Herstein says confabulating isn't necessarily a bad thing. For example, people who judge their own weaknesses too accurately are more likely to suffer from depression.
We need a little bit of confabulation just to get through life. We need a little bit of self-deception. We need to tell ourselves that we are basically good people, we're important people. our projects matter, you know, as a motivational thing. Otherwise, if we're just sort of bluntly realistic about everything, it's hard to get out of bed in the morning.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. Confabulation and a weak grip on truth, pillars of American society. I'm John Perry. With me is my Stanford fellow philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And we're talking today about the evolution of storytelling. We're joined now by Jonathan Gottschall. He's a professor of English from Washington and Jefferson College. He's author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Jonathan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
John, Ken, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Jonathan, you're an English professor, so almost by definition, you're interested in stories. But
That's
you
right.
go beyond that. You're interested in how the process of storytelling evolved. What about storytelling and its evolutionary roots is it that you find so fascinating?
Well, story has no obvious biological importance. If you look at things that have sort of similar salience in human life, for instance, our greed for food, which you guys brought up in the last segment, or our greed for sex, those things make obvious biological sense. They obviously helped our ancestors survive and reproduce. But if you have something like storytelling that has this sort of enormous salience in human life, and yet it's very hard to see what the evolutionary payoff was, then you have something that's very appealing to evolutionary thinkers, and that's an evolutionary mystery, a riddle.
Well, but wait a minute. Isn't that just so? I mean, why?
What's wrong with just so?
Well,
I mean, the thing with just so storytelling is it's been a very useful critique for sort of shutting down evolutionary thinking. But a just so story is just a hypothesis. It's a historical narrative about how this thing might have come into being. And all evolutionists rely upon them. They all tell evolutionary stories about
you're making a pretty strong claim. The subtitle of your book is How Stories Make Us Human. I mean, mm-hmm. humans are the only animals to wear clothes, too, but I wouldn't say that clothes are what make us human. Why do you think stories are so important?
Well, my next book is the trouser-wearing monkey. That'll be the next book. Why is it so important? Well, there's this old debate among philosophers and scientists. You guys know about this, about what makes a human a human. And there's been a lot of different arguments about it. When you call the species Homo sapien, you're making an argument. The argument is that it's human intelligence, human sapience, human wisdom that most sets our species apart. But other people say, no, we're not actually all that rational, all that logical. It's really upright posture or opposable thumbs or the sophistication of culture or language. And I'm not downplaying any of that. I'm just saying that one thing is typically left off the list, and that's storytelling, the way that humans tend to live their lives inside stories.
Okay,
humans are the beast.
Okay. You said a lot of different things here, and we're going to have to unravel some of it. Humans tell stories. They've always told mm-hmm. stories. Okay, I got that. Stories are fun. Stories are entertaining, you know. Life is a story. I really don't yet see even the temptation to say there's an evolutionary explanation of storytelling. I know you think there is, but tell me what tempts you to believe that there must be an evolutionary explanation of storytelling. Briefly.
A few things. One is if you have something that occupies a species to the extent that storytelling does, you assume that it must have had some sort of evolutionary payoff, or else it would have been selected against by natural selection. Other evidence includes the spontaneous storytelling that happens, including children's pretend play. Children play naturally at story, including dreams, where we spontaneously dream in stories. The fact that stories are structured the same way all around the world. Not only that we have stories, no matter where you go across cultures, no matter where you go across centuries, but they tell stories that are basically just like ours.
Well, you know, you said a lot of things, and we're going to have to dig into some of the things like this claim that all stories have the same structure. That one I'm not so sure of, but we'll come back to this. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about the evolution of storytelling with Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal.
Do stories have an evolutionary function, several different functions, or are they just one big evolutionary accident?
The stories that humans tell, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
You're a storyteller, you might think you're without responsibility, and you can lead your characters anywhere you
Scene, plot, and character, main ingredients of that essential or non-essential human activity of storytelling. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about the evolution of storytelling.
Our guest is Jonathan Gottschall. He's the author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human.
So, Jonathan, I want to slow down a little bit here. So you have this evolutionary approach to storytelling. I mean, I'm going to grant you that stories do lots of cool things in our lives. They play lots of cool roles in our lives. But you think evolution storytelling had an evolutionary function, and it wasn't just a byproduct of evolution, had an evolutionary function. What do you think the evolutionary function of storytelling was?
Well, I hate to say it, but it's kind of a long answer to this question.
Well, try to make it compact.
Yeah.
So don't give me the long version. Give me the short version.
If you look at your hand and you ask yourself, what's the evolutionary purpose of my hand? It's a long answer. You have to say my hand is for reaching out and grabbing stuff. It's for caressing. It's for waving around the air and making sense. It's for a lot of stuff. It's a multi-purpose tool, like a Swiss Army knife, not a single-purpose tool. My guess is that story serves a similar sort of function. It's for a lot of things. So some people think that it's, you know, about group cohesion, that it helps societies work better and function better. Some people think it's a sort of virtual reality simulator. Some people think it's an evolutionary byproduct. All these ideas are in play. What we needed to do is attract a lot more sort of experimental scientists to sort of test and tease out these different hypotheses. But all these different ideas can be true at the same time. So it's a very complex question.
So let me try out a different answer, or maybe it's one of the competing answers on you. This is what I put forward in my book, Reference and Reflexivity, which is now shot up to number 650,000 on the bestseller list, by the way. The language evolved. It has a clear evolutionary and adaptive function, which is sharing information. And then it just turned out that language was fun. And there isn't enough information to occupy us, so we start telling stories about dead people that can't do us much good, and then there's not enough dead people, so we start telling stories about made up people. In that sense, storytelling would be kind of what evolutionary theorists call a spandrel. It's not something that itself had a function, but it just kind of came out of some other things that did have a function.
Yeah, why not believe that, Jonathan?
I think it's perfectly acceptable to believe that as a hypothesis. I think right now we have to be pretty humble about things. The byproduct hypothesis is very much in play. So right now what you have is a plethora of sort of competing ideas, and what we really need is more data to decide between them.
Let's say something more about what you mean by a story. Now, from reading your book, you mostly talk about fiction. Right. You mostly talk about sort of made up stories. Is that right? Is that what you mostly mean by stories? So when you're talking about the evolutionary function of storytelling, you're talking about the evolutionary function of engaging in fictional story making.
Yeah, for the most part, that's where I'm concentrating.
But that seems to me a big mistake, a really deep and important mistake, because human life has a narrative structure. I mean, I have to narrate my own life. I have to say, what have I been? What am I becoming? Moreover, other people are trying to narrate my life at the same time. They're trying to say, you're my slave, you're my this, you're my that. And by narrating, and this competing narratives of our own lives are about how we live together or don't live together. It seems to me storytelling is not primarily about fiction. It's primarily about narrating reality in the real human drama and what we owe to one another. And I actually think that's partly where you start to go off the rails, when you focus on fiction rather than the role of, you know, narrative structure in a human life in general. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I disagree with you there.
Of course
I think
you do.
the book has an emphasis on fiction, perhaps, but it certainly is about the humans as storytelling animals more broadly as well. So all of that stuff you just referenced about the sort of personal life stories that people make about attempts to frame reality using narrative, that's all there in the book. And that's the kind of thing that people don't have trouble admitting sort of has an evolutionary functionality.
Right, exactly. But see, Jonathan, if you start there with the role of the narration of our lives and the competing narratives of our lives and are trying to get through this lived life, if you start there, then you don't get into a lot of trouble, because you don't start with, what's the evolution? Evolutionary function of made-up stories. Made-up stories are a derivative kind of thing.
But that's the puzzling thing. I mean, you're attracted to that one because that is the mystery. That, you know, that's the one that doesn't have the sort of obvious explanation.
I mean, I'm a little on Jonathan's side here, because most of what Ken listed sounds like fiction to me. I mean, maybe it's semi-fiction, but, you know, you go back, I mean, probably the distinction between fiction and truth doesn't itself play any big evolutionary role. You go back to ancient stories like the Iliad. Well, those were narratives that gave cohesion and a story and ideals to the Greek peoples that told them. That doesn't have much to do with truth. You look at today's political election and look at the stories that are being told about the purpose of America and our exceptionalism. Stories, mostly fiction. Not labeled as fiction, not bound as a novel, but fiction.
Oh, I totally agree with you in a certain way. I mean, so I think the human capacity for narrative goes amok because we're trying to narrate everything. We're trying to narrate our lives. We're trying to narrate our nations. We're trying to narrate the conflicts between us. Then we can, you know, that's about, we're trying to narrate real live events, but we're also trying to, we also just make up narratives because, I don't know, I think the narrative capacity runs amok. I don't think fiction, I'm just saying fiction is not the starting point. The starting point of this capacity is not telling made-up stories. That's what I think you got wrong. You seem to think it's about, why do we tell made-up stories? That's just a byproduct of our storytelling capacities, which is not about made-up stuff. Although it does have fictional elements because it doesn't answer to the truth. What do you think of that barrage, Jonathan?
Well, it was a barrage. I'm reeling a little bit. I think you're getting it wrong. I think you've misread the book. The book starts with the most florid riddle, which is the evolutionary riddle of fiction. Why do we spend so much time of our brief lives obsessed with the fake struggles of fake people? It's really a strange thing. It's something that biologists wouldn't expect. But as you get into deeper chapters, there's absolutely questions about this, about the human storytelling mind in general, and how it's not just a fiction thing. You know, we all have these brain circuits that are designed to find story pattern in the world, and you're absolutely right. If we don't find that story pattern in the world, we are only too eager to make stories up, and that's why we get urban legends, and that's why we get conspiracy theories, and why wildly different political narratives told by liberals and conservatives and so on and so forth forever.
Okay, Jonathan, before we start taking calls, I just want to get one thing from you. You mentioned that we need more experimental work. Now, the experimental work isn't going to look at how storytelling evolved directly. It'll have to look at the function that storytelling plays in current society and then see if that offers some suggestions. Could you give us just a few words about what, in your investigation, what is the main function that storytelling does for us today?
Well, I'll give you the hypothesis that I spend the most time with. It's sort of might be called the flight simulator model. And so it starts with an observation. The observation is that stories are about trouble. Why are they about trouble? Arguably, it's because, you know, if you have a pilot and they get into a flight simulator, and the idea is that you practice up on the big problems of flying a plane. And maybe fiction serves a similar purpose. We go into a story, we practice up on the big problems of human life, and we get better at it as a result. Now, this has testable hypotheses that come out of it. One is that people will actually be better at various social tasks because they've simulated these social realities inside fiction. And there's several different psychological studies that have found at least tentative evidence that people who consume a lot of fiction outperform heavy nonfiction consumers in tests of things like empathy and social ability.
Interesting.
So let's take some callers. B from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, B.
Hello. I wanted to share an example of the evolutionary role of storytelling, in which I think the exception proves the rule. When the Spanish came to California, they enslaved the native people, many of whom were hunter-gatherers. And the peoples that were around the San Francisco Bay Area had a taboo against telling any story that involved a dead person. So once a person had died, any conversation about what he did or how he did it or what or she was just unable to be spoken. The missionaries enslaved those people, took them away from their hunter-gathering lifestyle, and taught them to build and raise the mission buildings and taught them how to farm. And when those who were left over after disease decimated the population were finally let free, they didn't know how to live because nobody had been able to tell the stories of, this is how you fish. My grandfather told me how to make a fish hook. Well, you couldn't reference anything that had to do with a dead person. So unless you yourself had that skill, and could train another person because you had learned it, you couldn't share the survival skills with the other people in your tribe who had survived the enslavement.
B, thanks for the question. So, Jonathan, these things raises a lot of questions, but one thing it raises for me, and then you can talk about whatever you want, but one thing it raises for me is stories about how to fish that you learned from your ancestors. Those aren't about, you said all stories about trouble and stuff like that. I mean, do you not count these oral traditions that pass on the ways of a people as stories or not, or what?
Well, I'll thank B for her interesting question, and say it. The story she tells amazes me. That's not to say I'm at all skeptical, but I always thought that history, talking about dead people, was really a very central function of our use of language, and one that made a certain amount of sense is just a continuation of the basic information exchanging function. You start out saying, well, you use language to say, you know, Socrates is over at the forums, Antipa might tell Alcibiades, and then he knows where to find Socrates. And that's very useful, and it has an evolutionary and adaptive function. And then, you know, Socrates dies, but it was so much fun talking about Socrates, let's keep it up. So Plato writes all these dialogues. And then here we've got a whole culture that isn't talking about dead people. That's very disruptive to my theory, but it might well be true.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tom in Oakland.
Hi. I like to look up the root meaning of words in the Proto-Indo-European language and also some in the Proto-Semitic languages. And the root meaning for the word story is to see. And there are many other words, like the wise or wisdom or idea or vision. And in the Sanskrit, Veda means knowledge. And history and story come from the Greek, and they refer to a learned man. And I think that would be a valuable part of your program, is to the root meanings of words in other language families to see where the ideas come from.
Thanks, Tom. Jonathan, you got any comment about that?
No, I don't.
Well, the idea that stories come from wise men I kind of like. So that means, you know, people like Ken should be telling us more stories.
So why don't we hear what Janet has to say? Janet from Larkspur?
Yeah.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Janet.
Hi. I just want to say that I think storytelling does have an evolutionary function because I grew up with a father who was maybe slightly bipolar, kind of withdrawn from his kids except for when he told us stories. And that was the only time that we could really get a feeling of his love for us and empathy. And at other times he could be almost terrifying. Not physically terrifying, but just psychologically terrifying to be around him.
Janet, how do you think that supports the evolutionary idea? I'm not sure
I would have survived to reproduce if I hadn't had that.
Okay, Jonathan, does that support the... Janet. How does that help? Does that kind of thing support the evolutionary hypothesis?
I don't know if her specific observation does, but, you know, let's look at it a slightly different way if we could. If you look at the sort of traditional storytelling, religion, folk tales, anthropologists have said for 100 years that these serve a function. They serve a function of teaching people how to live, teaching people what the values of the tribe are, teaching people what is good behavior, what is bad behavior, and they sort of have a group cohering sort of aspect to them. So one of the ideas about storytelling is that fiction does that. It's a social glue. It's a social sort of lubricant that makes societies work better. And that's kind of an interesting idea, too. And one of the questions then becomes is our current fiction still serving that basic sort of evolutionary purpose?
Right. So what's your... You said fiction does that. Suppose... I mean, the stories of a tribe, some of which are maybe fictional, some of which, you know, Johnny went off and did something bad to the tribe and got exiled, and we tell this story to teach our children not to be bad like Johnny was. It doesn't have to be fiction to serve that function, does it? I'm just trying to get
at it. No, but it almost always is. I mean, if you go into sort of world mythology, world folk tale, they're fictional, or maybe they had some sort of kernel of truth that's been elaborated and exaggerated. But the idea is that it serves a purpose for the tribe. And the question is, then becomes pretty obvious. Did that sort of function help human groups survive better, reproduce better? And is that one of the reasons that we might have storytelling?
Well, this is kind of an interesting hypothesis here. The idea is that storytelling, in a neutral sense, where we talk about either fiction or fact, is very important for intergenerational transmission of values and bonding. And then the idea is, but you know, the facts don't just offer enough material or the right material. The story you want to tell is about a really bad boy. Well, maybe there isn't a really bad boy, but you can invent a really bad boy, and that will make the story much better. So I think that's an interesting idea.
Do you agree with that interesting idea, Jonathan?
I do completely, yeah. Yeah, it's one of the ideas I really spend a lot of time on in the book is this, again, this idea that maybe what stories are for, and I spend a lot of time with religious stories, is, again, just to make not the individual life better, but to make the community life better, to make the whole community more cohesive, more harmonious, more competitive.
Of course, now the community is going to tell some stories that it serves its purpose, but I can reject those stories. I can be like, I don't know, a slave in the antebellum South, and there are the stories of why the white guys deserve to be my master. And I hear those stories, and I'm supposed to believe them, but I say, heck no. I mean, what about that kind of thing, the contestation of stories in human? Because it seems to me stories aren't just told. They're told by the powerful to the powerless. They're rejected. They're counter-narratives. What about that sort of thing?
Well, you have
story?
I think it's really interesting. The idea, if story serves a sort of group level function for in evolutionary terms, it doesn't mean it serves all groups. You know, every tribe would have its own narrative. Every group would have its own narrative. Every class would have its own narrative. And so the stories would emerge to serve the interests of the group, not to serve the other interests of the other group. In fact, it's arguable that they would be designed to serve the interests of the group as they compete with other groups.
I just want to mention for the record that for the last few minutes we've actually been discussing a question that one of our emailers asked, Greg Slater, who said, I get the constant impression that humans are always driven to embellish reality. Is reality so boring and uncompelling that we can't tell it or take it straight? It seems so, and this imperative to spruce it up infects everything, including storytelling. Well, I think he's got a point, and we've been making it, and you could probably apply it to contemporary politics if you wanted to get controversial.
This is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the evolution of storytelling with Jonathan Gottschall from Washington and Jefferson College. He's the author of The Storytelling Animal.
How is technology changing the way we tell stories? Suppose all of our stories were limited to 140 characters. Would that or will that radically change the nature of storytelling? Or is there something essential to storytelling that transcends tweeting?
Technology and the evolution of storytelling, when Philosophy Talk continues. Every minute after midnight, all the time I'm spending, it's just for working on the rewrite, that's right, I'm gonna turn it into cash.
Paul Simon, working on the rewrite. Good old Paul Simon, slip out the back, Jack. We're working on the question, does storytelling serve an evolutionary purpose? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal. Jonathan, I want to ask you quickly about something you say in your book. You say, I'm a big fan, I'm a Chomskyite, I believe in the universal grammar. You kind of say there's a universal grammar of storytelling. I'm not sure I agree with you, but tell us a little bit about your idea of how all stories share a common structure.
Yeah, this is sort of one of the most impressive things for me about my research was, you know, it's sort of a cliche. It's an English 101 cliche. It's a creative writing one cliche that, you know, a story has to be about a problem. It has to have conflict. And I sort of knew that, but it's still impressive to go across cultures, to go across societies, to go across history and to find the same pattern everywhere you go and to find the same pattern not only in sort of artful fiction, but to find it in children's play and to find it in dreams. It's always trouble-centered. So the universal grammar of storytelling is that stories are about characters confronting problems or confronting trouble and trying to overcome it.
But there are some counterexamples that you consider modernist fiction. James Joyce Finnegan's
yeah,
Wake.
Yeah,
Ulysses. Yeah, no, Ulysses. I guess Ulysses. I guess you would count as within your, but the Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
But now that sounds like you're dismissing the counterexamples as, well, they're stories that don't have their share structure, but they're just not interesting. But they're still stories, aren't they?
Well, yeah. It's actually interesting to see whether people would define them as stories or not. I think that there are counterexamples. They almost always come from artists who decided, oh my gosh, I'm working inside a prison. I'm working inside this prison of problem structure about you know all these formulas, and I need to break out. And it might be interesting as art. It might be interesting as an experiment. But for the most part, these are stories, if they are stories, that you can't get most people to read or to watch.
Well, you know, even if there weren't a universal grammar of storytelling in as strong a sense as Chomsky thinks there is for human language, the idea that there are paradigms that cover an enormous number of cases seems to me extremely fascinating. Now, when I was in college, we were told about, you know, the adventures of the hero is kind of the universal form. You have a hero, he's in good shape, something terrible happens to him, then he fights his way back up and becomes, you know, maybe in worse shape, but an improved human being. Is that really a pretty common prototype story, particularly in the older myth-making era of human civilization? Well, I don't know. I love that because I used to use that teaching Descartes. I teach Descartes as the form of the hero, right? Descartes starts off and in the meditations, he knows all sorts of things, and then he begins doubting, and that's like falling down a hill for the hero or being exiled. And then he fights his way and he claws his way, mostly with bad arguments, back right. to the position of knowing something.
So,
the paradigm of the heroic voyage.
I think there are lots of paradigm story structures. There are genres. It's non-accidental that stories come in genre. I think that's all true. But, you know, ask yourself, why is that? Is that because, you know, the Chomsky and universal grammar of language is supposed to be built into our genes somehow? Mm-hmm. Right, and that seems plausible, although lots of people disagree with that. The idea that it's built into our genes, the Chomskyan idea about universal grammar of language is that it's built into our genes, right? But the idea that the structure of stories are built into the genes or the very structure of the human mind or something, that I'm not sure why I should believe. Why should I believe that? Rather than they evolve historically, you know, because people are,
well,
you know,
okay, because you find it everywhere. You find it across cultures, across history. You find it in dreams. You find it in pretend play. And it's not at all obvious that stories should be structured that way. Mm-hmm. If you're a Martian anthropologist or something, a Martian literary scholar, you'd probably expect stories to be about these sort of realizations of paradise or utopia, where you go in there and you'd have this wonder world of fried ice cream and hedonistic sex and rainbows and unicorns and no one would get hurt. But we don't find that. We find that fictions of all kinds are closer to hellscapes than heavens. They tend to end happily, but only after the protagonist has been tortured sufficiently.
Well, I think that's fascinating because, I mean, actually the Martian story sounded pretty good to me. So there is this question, why aren't we happy with stories that say, well, this guy was having a lot of fun, and then he had more fun, then he had even more fun
right.
at the end.
Right.
Well, I agree. That's not very interesting. Now, the question is, why isn't that very interesting?
Well, it could be interesting, depending on the fun.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, just... I mean, people like pornography, people like pornographic stories, and that's not conflicts to be overcome. I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, the story of those things lasts, like, the sort of narrative part lasts, like, a little bit, it's more fun after fun after fun after fun after fun, and people watch that stuff and consume that stuff out the wazoo. So
I've never seen any of that. Why don't you tell us more?
So, Jonathan, what about pornography, which is a
kind
of
literature? Well, porn is actually a great example, I think, of a counterexample. Porn does to be sort of, it is hedonistic wish fulfillment where everything is wonderful, at least according to the consumer.
Sometimes.
However, the main draw of porn, as we all know, it has nothing to do with the story, and in recent years, story has gone almost completely out of porn. It's more reality
show
style.
It has nothing to do with what you're calling the story. I mean, if the story is just one event after another, if a possible story is just one event after another, then your account of story is
yeah,
not
but I'm
true.
I'm not defining story that way. I'm defining story a little more rigorously as something that hews to the universal grammar. So one thing after another is a narrative, but not a story.
Well,
that's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm saying. You defined away the counterexample because you said that doesn't count as a story by the definition you started with.
Yeah, but just to get
Definition gets so broad that everything becomes a story and it becomes not a useful term anymore.
Well, that just means the notion of story is not a useful notion as such.
Well,
your definition of story, if it's just one thing after another, is not a useful definition of story.
But to follow up on porn with a kind of an interest, what seems to be an interesting question, I wonder if written porn has evolved the way visual porn has, or if we looked at written porn, even in the computer age, is there still usually a story that would fit in there? And maybe visual porn really is a different phenomenon than storytelling. That seems like an interesting thought to me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, it's a good point. My guess is that erotica, the literary erotica, again, not that any of us have ever experienced any of this in our lives, but my guess is that literary erotica is much more problem structured, story based. For instance, 50 Shades of Grey is a great example of something that's read for erotic titillation, but the story is certainly important as well.
John asked a question that let's broaden the question. So the way stories evolved, if they evolve, I suppose, is face-to-face communication around the campfire and then oral histories and stuff like that passed from generation to generation. Now, then, you know, something happened, the printing press and all this, and the reach of stories was greater. Technology gives us many more possibilities. Do you think technology, and so part of me believes that if film had been invented before the book would have never happened. I mean, does technology change the nature of storytelling at all? Or the function of it or anything like that?
It absolutely does, and it absolutely doesn't. You know, the form of the story changes, you know, from oral tales to printed books to films and TV and reality shows and iPods and all this kind of stuff. But deep down, the story is always, always, always the same. It is as it was and as it ever will be. Stories are about characters confronting problems and seeking to overcome them. That doesn't seem to ever change, and I don't expect it to change until human nature does.
What do you think of stories in which not much happens? You know, I could name some examples, but maybe I won't. But there are stories that are a lot of thinking and describing, but not much happens. Just the internal life of the story.
You're thinking
story.
Proust here?
Yes, I'm thinking Proust, but I didn't want to say that because my friend Josh Landy, who loves Proust, might hear this. You know? What do you think of those kind of stories? Not much happens in a lot of stories. A lot of modernist stories.
Again, stories are but they still tend to be trouble-based. They still tend to be about an internal dilemma, some kind of issue, some kind of problem that needs to be confronted. Truly, stories that are truly different, truly break the universal grammar, are very rare. And, you know, so you might have a slice of life story that's just about normal life as it's actually lived. Like, you know, I got up in the morning, I ate breakfast. And it just doesn't draw our attention. In order for a story to draw our attention and to hold our attention, it has to have a sort of knotty problem at the center, and the knottier the problem, the more we like it.
Do you think? I'm not clear what you believe. Just want a statement of what you believe. Do you think that there's like a gene that dictates, or a set of genes that dictate the structure of this universal grammar of stories?
I don't know. I'd have to be I wish I could be more dogmatic about it, but I actually feel fairly agnostic about that. There's just not enough to go on yet to decide.
Okay,
it could be a side effect. Go ahead.
I want you to give me your best guess about how
a gene. No, I wouldn't think there'd be a gene. There could be a suite of genes that are associated with it, but I wouldn't. I don't think it's a very interesting question, to be honest. The interesting question is, where do we get these sorts of behaviors from? Is it from, you know, a byproduct of the fact that we just like to be excited? You know, so maybe stories are about problems because problems are much more exciting and interesting. And as you guys have been suggesting, it might just be a byproduct of those facts. Or is problem structure part of the design of stories because it serves an evolutionary function? It serves a sort of flight simulator model of helping us try out problems in fiction and not die at the end. You know, we get the benefit of the experience without dying at the end.
Well, that sounds like a good insight. Certainly, I mean, I love stories. I love getting the benefit of the experience without dying in the end. So on that note, I'm grateful to you for helping us think about stories in evolutionary terms, and I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Our guest has been Jonathan Gottschall. He's a professor of English from Washington and Jefferson College. He's author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. So, John, has your thinking about stories evolved or devolved today?
Well, interesting guest, interesting book. He tells a nice story. Universal grammar for stories probably is as plausible as universal grammar for languages. A very interesting and productive hypothesis. Whether it leads us to really think that all human language is just a matter of parameter setting of some kind of a genetically endowed basic thing is pretty dubious in both the cases of grammar and storytelling. But, you know, bold hypotheses make for good research.
Well, that's true. And interesting radio, it turns out. Bold hypotheses make for interesting radio. I can't tell if you are in favor of the universal grammar of story idea or not in favor of it. But, I mean, I do think it's an intriguing idea. I think, you know, it's worth digging into. And I think there's some advantage for thinking about stories in evolutionary terms. But this story here, you know, I'm going to write something more about this. You're going to write something more about this. This story here is a long story, and it will continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our stories on Twitter via our tweets, and you can find out more by visiting our very active, ever-growing Facebook page.
And wait, there's more. How about this? You can now sign up to get the free, that's absolutely free, no charge whatsoever, the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website. That website is philosophytalk.org. That's philosophytalk.org. Now, a special treat, a man with a story to tell. A man with a story to tell and not a moment to spare. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, as a child, I used to spend hours with my friends in strange debates. Would you rather be rolled on a hill in a barrel full of nails or have bamboo splints shoved under your fingernails? We would try to think up the most horrible tortures imaginable and choose which we would think would be the least worst. And when I ate grapes, I would carefully peel the skin off one, pretend it was an eyeball, then pop it in my mouth. I don't do that anymore. Nor do I announce when having a plate of spaghetti, "Look, everybody, I'm eating worms." If we do something worthy, we tend not to brag about it. Oh, shucks, it weren't nothing. If we do something foolish, on the other hand, we tend to exaggerate it in the telling, to make ourselves look even more foolish than we were. This is the heart of most stand-up comedy. And we love our memoirs, even when we find that many of them are fake, or parts have been plagiarized, or made up whole cloth. The alleged orphan, who had to drink the urine of rabid bats to survive, has to make a tearful confession to Oprah that he was actually quite wealthy as a child, had two parents who loved him, and who gave him hand-squeezed lemonade every day. There's a certain falseness inherent in any memoir or autobiography anyway. When I read that you had sex with Liz Taylor, I think, wow, but I also think, why are you telling me this? It's kind of creepy. I don't blame writers for making up stuff about their lives. I mean, I enjoy my life, but I wouldn't find it interesting to read about. Last night, for example, I watched a bad action movie on TV and then reread a Raymond Chandler novel until I fell asleep. If I were to write my memoir, I'd have to claim that I built the TV myself out of string and dirt, that I had to snatch the Chandler novel from the hands of a dangerous intruder. This is why people turn to Twitter. It's the telegram of the 21st century. Because you can only use 140 characters, it makes everything punchy and dramatic. Watching movie, reading Chandler, life is good. Pretending grape is eyeball, follow me. Now they're all texting and tweeting and Facebooking and making Tumblr pages or posting the boring crafts we made on Etsy, live blogging or going on Kickstarter to raise money for a DVD of our garage band, clicking on links, making memes go viral. Soon we won't even need memoirs. We're all of us just out there all the time, each on our own never-ending stories, which are all, by the way, awesome. Our actual lives may not be juicy grapes anymore, just a handful of shriveled raisins. But once you go online, eyeballs, eyeballs, eyeballs. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.